live and direct. You're tuned in to the Bro Diallo Show, broadcasting straight out of the sanctuary hypocrisy that is the city of Chicago, Drillinois. The state of Drillinois. Anyway, it is April 19th in the year of your Lord, 2017, and you are tuned in live to... I wish I could come up with like a some type of monkey or like the most dangerous man in AM radio. I don't know. I'll figure out something where I am the most controversial. I don't know. I'll figure out something where I could be the most, and then I'll start claiming it. But right now, it's just Bro Diallo, straight up and down. Let's jump in with both feet. Yesterday, we have another mass shooter. You know, one thing about mass shooter, it's just curious, living in Chicago, you know, especially a lot of our young people. I work with young people in, what they call them, at-risk youth, which is just... Let me not get into that, but I work with young people between the ages of 16 and 18, you know, with King Dita and I, with one of our programs, the Green Teens program. And, you know, it's kind of funny to see the whole nation is kind of being subjected to what it feels to be black all the time, you know, insecure at any moment. You know, your life, your well-being, your personal, physical integrity can be compromised or violated for no other reason than who you are, what you look like. You know, and I remember in 2001, September 11th, a lot of social commentators, social scientists, and comedians made the statement that, you know, after September 11th, false flag terror attacks, everybody got a little chance to see what it felt like to be black in America. Because, I mean, not from day, from the era of chattel slavery to the era to post-Obama America, whether, you know, we were defined as subhuman, three-fifths human, as chattel, to the point where, you know, we're some of the most recognized entertainers, you know, some of the most accomplished scholars and achievers and strivers in America. That fundamental reality has not changed. And, you know, America as a nation, white people as a race, the U.S. court systems, of course, the policing agencies, the social service agencies, and the private industry like to give us those little reminders. No matter how much the Oprahs and Bill Cosbys want us to forget, the nation has to remind us, you know, that we have no rights that the white man is bound to respect. You know, with that was the famous word from the Dred Scott's decision. And now we do have rights that the white man is bound to respect. But who's doing the binding? We don't bind him. If they disrespect our rights, if they kill our children on tape in front of the world, and impose no consequences on the murderers, we have to go to them. So now we have rights that the white man is bound to respect at his discretion. Is that progress? I suppose. But whenever I would read the Dred Scott decision, that word bound is what stuck with me. Everybody else said, oh, the black man has no rights. The black man has no rights. Oh, my goodness. They said we didn't have rights. The country denied us rights. eh, you know, that wasn't the biggest deal to me. Because if you study the reality of rights, you go back to, especially in Western society, you go all the way back to Magna Carta. When Europeans, or you even go back to the social contract with Rousseau, or you even go back to the earliest experiments in European democracy, the Greeks, forums, you know, the Roman plutocrats, you'll see that rights are, you know, are not a static thing. A right you had today can be, you know, giveth and it can be taketh away. So I don't get too up in arms about rights because they're not static. What's more important about rights is who's issuing the rights, who's denying the rights, you know, who's enforcing the rights, and who is bound by the rights, and what are the consequences for those who issue the rights, who oversee the rights, who administer the rights. What are the consequences for violating the rights? You know, because we had our civil rights struggle. And yes, this is a rabbit hole, but let's explore it a little further. We in the civil rights struggle, we had our eyes on the prize, oh Lord. We had our eyes on the prize. And I'm sorry for singing. I'm sorry. But certain things I just can't say. You know, you have those experiences in your life where you can't say it without singing it. You know, if you were born sometimes in the early to mid 70s to the early 80s, if I say first things first, what comes to your mind? I won't even complete it. But anyway, we had our eyes on the prize. We had a civil rights movement. And then we got hip over time. We got real slick. Like, wait a minute, civil rights, that limits us to the government. But we want to go to The Hague. We want to go to the international court. We want to go to the UN. So we're not going to talk civil rights because that limits us to the state and federal government. Let's talk about human rights. That way we get to go on a global stage with our mess. And I said mess. But we never really dealt with the issue. We dealt with the issue of saying, hey, white folks, write this thing down on paper. Write down that I'm human. So, okay, white man begrudgingly wrote 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Okay, you're human. You're a person. But he threw in a little asterisk and said, so are corporations, by the way. We can really, you know. And then then he wrote, you're a citizen, right? And then he wrote down, you're covered by the Constitution. All rights, you are full citizens of the United States. You get to enveloped under the umbrella, the aura of the U.S. Constitution. And the fact that it was written, because I think if it was really, if after the Civil War, after the emancipation, after the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th, the Black Amendments, of the constitutions that have been stolen away from us and co-opted by. But after all of that, I think if the United States was really sincere about Black folks' rights, they would have had another constitutional convention. The states would have called for, I think you need 3/4 of the states to call for a constitutional convention, state houses. And they have to call for, I have to read, you know, that's political science 101. Dr. Dima, one of my favorite political science professors, would be so upset with me if he knew I just didn't even, I don't remember offhand the process for calling for a constitutional convention. But anyway, if the United States was sincere about, hey, yeah, if I stole you away from your homeland, then I'm sorry. If I just spent generations exploiting your labor, and I became the wealthiest nation of the world off of your labor and left you impoverished, then I'm sorry. If I raped, mutilated, dehumanized you, then I'm sorry. If that was really a sincere thing to do, if it wasn't just political theater, which it was, but if it wasn't that, they should have had another constitutional convention. And they should have said, you know, now that we've given full citizenship to blacks, we're going to have to rewrite this whole thing because this thing was only written for the landed gentry, white men who owned land. That's who this Constitution was written for. And we can't honestly expand it to include everyone else unless they have a hand in a say, because this is a representative republic and you're not represented here. You know, you can't, like the Boy Scouts, it's for boys. If you wanted to fully incorporate girls, you have to bring girls on deck and allow them to assert, okay, there's some things, there's some deficiencies here. There's some things that don't speak to my needs, to as a citizen. I'm not equal to you. Let's not play this game. But there was no Constitutional Convention. And the Constitutional Convention should have brought black men to the table, not black women or white women, because remember, black women did not get the right to vote in what, 1868, 1869, whatever, late 1860s, early 1970s, that era, as they were putting forth all these progressive abolitionist policies, and the United States was trying to rebuild from a bloody white tribal war. And white people kill each other in mass by the millions, and we don't call it tribalism. You know, white folks, you know, the French don't trust the Germans hate the British and all that, but we never call that tribalism because that's disrespectful. That's putting white people on the level of black folks and Asians and other swarthy, unwashed rabble of the world. When white people beat the hell out of each other with muskets, or they bombing the hell out of other people, Croatia, the Balkans, that's not tribalism. That's not savage, brutal tribal warfare. That's, you know, international conflict. And that's why we gotta work on our language. We keep, you know, making their stuff legitimate and then leaving our stuff, you know. Or, I mean, what's this game about? But let me not get too far off the topic. They should have a constitutional convention and allow brothers to come in and say, okay, let me read over this. Okay. You know, we need to add some of this, take some of that away, stir it up, ratify it, states accept it, then we can move on. But that's never been done. We're still under the slaveholders. We're still under the genocide committers, the massive rapist, land-grabbing, invading imperialist constitution. And that has never been changed. And then in the 1920s, when women... White women like to talk about, you know, especially feminists. Even black men had rights before white women. Yeah, you know, but that's our whole thing. That's what we starting off the day, rights. All right. So at that time when women were given the franchise, women's suffrage movement granted them the franchise, there should have been another constitutional convention. And say, okay, now women have full citizenship rights or fully recognized as full adult citizen. They're able to enter because it wasn't just the voting right. That's what people don't understand. And, you know, even if you're an anti-feminist, you should know this history. Women were not allowed to enter into contracts. I mean, I could just go down the list. But women were essentially children under the eyes of the law. And there was even a point where women couldn't testify in court. I mean, this country was, I mean, you and people look at Saudi Arabia and nations like Dubai or Pakistan or even Turkey for a lot of instances where women are openly denied rights. People don't even play that game. Like in the United States, they like to pretend like, yeah, women are equal, women are free, you're a woman, let me hear you roar. You know, where they even front, United States fronts like it respects or have reverence for women, you know, and respects the autonomy and dignity of women. But there are some nations that don't even pretend, but the United States used to not even bother to pretend. So women could not, you know, were not allowed to work outside of very specific industries. You know, and even when, like, women were allowed to be school teachers or school moms, but the schools greatly controlled. They would impose curfews on the teachers and tell the teachers in their own time, when they're off the clock, saying there's certain places you can't go to the bar, you can't go to certain places escorted by men. You know, where do you think Islam got this mess from? Islam is just a bastardized version of Christianity, believe it or not. So it got all of it. A lot of its in its imperialist push, Islamic imperialism, it came out of Christianity. And then Christianity got the woman hating and woman and sexism, misogyny from Judaism. And Judaism, they got it from, you know, the Greek religions and cults, the cult of Isis. And then you got the Thor. It's always there's always a central theme in all of these warlike religions of we hate women. Even when they were worshiping goddesses, those gods, look at Hera, you know, look at the Greek and Roman goddesses. They were raped. They were degraded by gods. Now, the man couldn't, now mortal men couldn't dis, but the male gods were the model for the men, and the female gods were the model for women, even though some men would worship various female gods. But look at how the female gods in the European pantheon of gods of antiquity, back when they had polytheistic religions, the female gods were horrible too. They were very horrible. It was a very antagonistic relationship. That whole God is a savior, God is benevolent, that Christianity, Islam, and Judaism pushes. Well, they don't even push it, because God is a vengeful, wrathful, murderous, homicidal, woman-hating in the Bibles. But believe it or not, the God that floods the whole earth, kills firstborn babies of a man whom heart he hardened. Like, how God hardened Pharaoh's heart and then get mad at what Pharaoh did? God for it basically hardened. But anyway, gods are a reflection of the culture. You have gods are very slothful. Some gods are very gentle. Some gods are very warlike and regressive, and it reflects the culture. But anyway, all that to say, if the United States was serious about bringing new people under the umbrella, the aura, the cloud of the U.S. Constitution, making them full citizens, then they have to reopen the books. Like, if you work for a company and then you come up to become an equal partner, an equal stakeholder, they got to open the books. And then you get to have a say about the policies of the company. You know, you get to sit on the board and say, you know, I want to go in this direction, or how to spend the money. They open up the books. So every time there's supposed to be this grand reform in America, they should open up the Constitution and say, okay, you know, you had no part in writing this. Nobody consulted you. You didn't have an opportunity to have your say. People who represent you, who have your common experience, didn't give input that could better relate to what you need from the state. The social contract, that is the Constitution, of what you are obligated to do for the state and what the state is obligated to do for you, and the limitations of the state. So they open it up if they're ever serious about, you know, bringing people in. But that's never been done. And that is a major reason why the same people who ruled America in 1776, and the founding of America, from the first 13 colonies, from sea to shining sea, before, just as they were revving up to cut a path of genocide and ecocide across from the Atlantic to the the West Ocean, but Pacific Ocean. I think I said it. Pacific Ocean. The Pacific Ocean. As they were revving up to do that, the same people who governed, who were the most wealthy, most influential, least likely to have the apparatus of the state repress them, and more likely to have their apparatus of the state speak to their direct and immediate interests. Same people, wealthy white men, 200 plus years ago, 1776, to wealthy white man, 2017, where a black male president has to be the squeakiest, clean president. Obama had to walk on. And I'm not a fan of, go back and listen to the archive. I'm not. Is it caping for Obama? I'm not an Obama. I was not an Obama supporter. I was an Obama critic as much, if not more, than a Trump critic. And it's just hard to be a Trump critic because Trump's lunacy is so obvious. But Obama had to be so clean. Even when he passed gas, he had to catch it in a sterile bottle and seal it up. He couldn't even let his gas loose. Obama couldn't let nothing slip out. Somewhere in the sub-basement of the White House, there's a vault full of Obama's farts. Because for 8 years, this man had to be absolutely flawless. And then you got this sloppy, orange, comb-over cokehead. And his sloppy mail order, you know, eugenic breeding stock wife, just, you know, staggering and slop and falling all over the country. And white folks are still there, you know, saluting, and they're still there with their hands over their heart. God bless America. You know, if Obama did for one day. What is Trump on? 90 days? He's almost at his 100-day, first 100 days, having accomplished literally nothing that he said he was going to do. But Obama, you know, could do, if Obama did for one day, if Obama did for 1 minute, if Obama said one sentence or sent out one, just one of Trump's tweets, if Obama sent out the same tweet, he'd be impeached. So that shows you that the Constitution, and one of the things that's most remarkable about the Constitution that the United States is, we're one of the oldest, if not the currently the oldest democracy in the world. When the United States became a democracy, most European nations were dictatorships or monarchies, you know. But this was the United States. It was federated, and it was confederate. And even when the Confederates tried to come, and they were like, nope, they didn't overthrow the democracy. Democracy held true even in during times, because usually when a civil war happens, that's when the dictators, the warlords, the totalitarian, they always, it becomes a repressive government. But the United States, like, even in the times of great national strife, we have maintained a constitutional representative democratic state, which isn't true. Abraham Lincoln did impose dictatorial powers, but he did render the Congress literally essentially defunct and was running. But let's just pretend America's a land of make-believe. If you believe it, if you will it, it will come true. The will of America can change the very elements. Let's just, for continuity purpose, let's just pretend that the rhetoric of America is actually factual, but it's not. But America has, and that's one of the things, America is a democracy and has maintained a democracy. And that's the great thing about democracy. But the democracy, was set up. Dale Jones, America is a criminal enterprise founded by a bunch of criminals. And one thing, and it is impressive, you can't tear it down. The fact that they've been able to consistently maintain a state that has basically, that pretends to be a democracy for all, but only been an oligarchy for the few, has been a windfall for the few. It doesn't even benefit all white people. I mean, white people have been dying. You know, they send working class, poor white people to kill off the natives, to suppress the slaves, send them to Guam, send them to the Philippines, send them to Cuba, send them to Panama, send them to Iraq, send them to Somalia, send them to Indonesia, send them to Cambodia, send them to Vietnam, send them to France, send them to the Balkans, send them to Germany. Working class white people have been bleeding all over the world. And so, but I mean, they're bleeding so that wealthy white men could literally take up and consume and control the resources of the world. But as a consolation prize, poor and working class white folks got better drinking fountains and better seats on the bus. Basically, they were just as poor, just as uneducated, just as malnourished as the rest of us. But and literally all these rednecks and white folks that were fighting against civil rights, fighting against right today, offering sanctuary to refugees who are fleeing American imperialism, running to America to escape American imperialism. I know it sounds contradictory, but that's how it works. You know, literally the only thing they have is that when a police car gets behind them, they might be a little less nervous than the rest of us. Other than that, they suffer. And I ain't just talking about Appalachia anymore. That used to be a concentrated belt of white poverty. But now, well, you go to Kansas. You go to Kentucky. Hell, you go to Brooklyn, New York. You go to Los Angeles, California, San Francisco. You think gentrification, poor white folks? White poverty. I mean, that's why white folks are injecting every gram of heroin that they can get their hands on. Heroin epidemic. White folks always been drugged out, but they ain't been out there like that. White folks have always consumed more drugs than anybody else. The $1 trillion global drug trade has been fueled by white veins, white nostrils, white lungs. And we think, you know, and drinking too. We just don't hold a candle to us. I know you go watch Menace to Society, you go watch New Jack City, and you think, wow, black folks are drugged out. No, we ain't. We don't know drugs. And the vast majority of drug abusers are employed, They're affluent. You know, you think you know what the trap house look like? Go to one of Donald Trump's mansion parties. You know, go to any Wall Street gathering. Talk about a trap house. No, these are trap skyscrapers. You know, ain't no trap, you know, dimly lit trap house. They literally got trap skyscrapers. If they ever did, you know, just they take bringing drug dogs through the hood. Take a drug dog into any of these international banks. The dog gonna pass out. The dog's gonna walk to the police precinct and hand in his resignation with a paw print on it. He can't sign his name. He's gonna put his paw in ink. Bam, like, I can't handle this. It's too much, man. I can't do this. White folks is drugged out. But even though they've been the drug community, they've been, you know, more white than black, is going to smoke crack tonight, whatever, that Tupac line where he, you know, said in the 90s, more white folks than black folks smoke crack. Statistically, raw, numerically, however you want to cut the numbers up, white folks get higher. White folks then put over $1 trillion of that stuff, of the good stuff, in their veins, in their nostrils, through their lungs, and now they even got skin patches, just absorbing it through the patches of their skin. And I'm not, and I'm, hey, I have a rather unique upbringing. Well, I wish it was. It's kind of typical. No, and I ain't talking about the hood part. I'm talking about my formal education. I went to the hood school, Southeast High School, junior high, shout out, south side of Kansas City. Southeast side of Kansas. I went to Southeast Junior, Knott's Elementary. I know I got some Kansas City listeners. D.A. Holmes. Anyway, I went to the hood schools where people like were like drug dealer royalty. Like you had generations, like, you know, how Trump is passing down his corrupt international business regime onto his children. That's how they used to do in the drug game. You had dudes used to be the weed man, the smack man, the crack man, and the meth man. They just level up through the drug game. And I'm like, wow, these people, they do drugs. And you could tell because they had the freshest Nike Air Jordans. They had the Lotto. Remember Lotto shoes, Lotto sweatsuits, the MCM making cash money, the Gazelle glasses. They had all that old tacky stuff. But then when I went to a private school, because, yeah, through some actions totally outside of my own young, youthful mind, out of my control, I was expelled, and my family was like, we could either send his ass to juvie, send his ass to foster care, or get up some money and put him in a good school away from all these bad influences. So they chose option 3. And if there was a God, I'd thank her for motivating them to do it. So I went off to a, and then I never saw. And then when I went to this private school, I started doing theater, which is, you know, a lot of the more affluent white kids. Or in my earlier years. Of course, since, you know, I don't want to get too far off. But long story short, I never saw drug abuse until I started being around affluent white folks. I never saw the level. And I mean, they stay drinking alcohol and they stay sniffing. They stay on the drugs. And I mean, these are highly hyper-functioning. Like Jimmy Fallon, they say he's a hyperfunctional. They've got a new term called hyperfunctional alcoholic, hyperfunctional. Not just a functional alcoholic or a functional addict, but hyperfunctional. Like they do better. They do more. You know, and look at Trump. Just watch. Trump got that thing they call Coke jaw, that grind, that Coke jaw. But, you know, I went a little too far down the rabbit hole. Let me back it all the way up. Let me get back to rights. You just know. And the fact, but let me just say that the fact that they have to keep making this music and making these movies and presenting these images as black folks on drugs, you ain't got to sell people reality. You ain't got to sell people something that's real. You know. So when you see something that's a meme, a trope, a reality that's constantly shown through the digital media, through the auditory music, through the audio media, it's gangster, we gangster, we gangster, we gangster, we do drugs, we stay high, we stay high, we stay high, we gangster, we stay high, we high gangster, killer, killer, killer. When they're selling, they don't have, if we were really the killers and the gangsters and the druggies that they said they were, they wouldn't have to sell it to us. And as sick as this man is, the only thing that outpaces their racism is their greed. in terms of the systems and institutions of capitalism and white domination. The only thing that outpaces racism is greed, which means they're not going to put money into something that they don't have to put money into, because they'd rather just roll around naked in that money as they toot, toot, snoot, snoot, sniff, sniff. So if they're putting literally millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and invested all kinds of infrastructure, media infrastructure, academic infrastructure, to say that black folks are the drug addicts, black folks are the criminals, they're not wasting that money. They're doing it for a purpose. They don't spend, the elites don't spend money. They only invest it. So they must be getting some return. And if we were truly the driller, killer, drug dealers, you know, you ain't got to give propaganda to a dog to get it to lick its butt. That's just something they do naturally. You ain't got to teach it to. It's going to do it. So if gangsterism, criminality, drug culture came naturally to us, they wouldn't have to invest billions of dollars. But you see, and it's just like, and I'm sorry. I said I was going to leave the rabbit hole, and here I am knee deep in it. But it, look at when in creation of the ghetto, right? When they created the ghetto, they thought, we'll build these structures, we'll encapsulate them, we'll pile the poorest, most uneducated black people into these structures. And like in some areas, they had the high rise projects, ghettos, and other areas, they didn't build up. They just built out. So they had like these literally villages. My housing project, subsidized housing, was called East Hills Village. They had holy temple houses, but they weren't high rise. They were 3-4-story buildings, but they were like stacked like Legos side by side instead of up. So sometimes they stack them side by side. Sometimes they build them up. But these were, as they say, right now, intentional communities. That's like something ecological that elite white people say, I want to build an intentional community. Well, the ghetto is intentional community. And the thing you have to understand about ghetto, not one ghetto in the world, whether you're talking about the Warsaw ghetto, whether you're talking about the favelas in Brazil, whether you're talking about the shanties in South Africa or the hood, Cabrini Green, and projects throughout, and black housing projects throughout the Northeast and West Coast coming out of the Deep South. No project was ever constructed by the people who lived in the projects. Poor people don't make ghettos. Rich people make ghettos. So when you want to talk about ghetto culture, it is not something that is constructed and orchestrated by the poor people. It is something constructed and orchestrated by the elites. So if you're anti-ghetto culture, like Bill Cosby, all these poor black people, if you don't like the conditions in of the ghetto and the type of mentality and behaviors that the ghetto produces, then you got to be mad at the public policymakers, the elite politicians, the financiers, the developers. But they didn't count on something. They put us in these ghettos, right? They put us in these ghettos, and they figured that's enough. We're going to concentrate the poverty, and then we're going to deprive them. We're going to deny them monetary resources, adequate food resources, adequate heating. We're not going to maintain the shelters. We're not going to give them any money. And that should be enough to make this, you know, because every superior white culture needs, you know, even when it's all white people. This is another characteristic of European imperialism. Even if it's all white people, if it was all white people, white folks got to have what Dr. Clark said, the process of niggerization. Dick Gregory spoke on this way back in the 70s. But they got, for some reason, they got to have a nigger. They got to have a whipping boy. They got to have a court gesture. Because I don't feel powerful if everybody I look at is my peer. Now, I would be happy. I'm a socialist. I'd be happy if everybody was as poor as me and I was rich as everybody else. I don't need to be above anybody. But there's something deep-seated in the elite mentality, in the oligarchical mentality, where they need a whipping boy. They need somebody. It's like my food tastes better if I know somebody's starving. My shelter, my mansion is more comfortable to me if I know someone's in the street. You know, my water is more invigorating if I know other people have to drink contaminated water. My clothes just make me feel better, instill me with more pride, my designer clothes, if I know other people are in rags. If I don't have anybody to compare and contrast to, anybody to look down and walk upon, then I could have everything, but it just seems like there's something missing. So they always need a nigga. And these are my words. I'm quoting. Somebody got to be the nigga. And if they don't have black people, they'll use Asians will do. Hispanics will do. If Asians and Hispanics will do, then they look amongst their own. Like, who can we niggify? The white woman could probably, historically, could probably be defined as the first nigga, you know, mistreated, looked down upon, subhuman, servant. You know, I could abuse you. I could burn you at the stake for being a witch. I accuse you of crimes that I know you didn't commit just so I can engage in thrill killing or the disabled. You know, or hey, you believe you have some type of dogma that's different than mine. I'm a Catholic. You're a Protestant. That's enough. You the nigga. No, you the nigga. Let's beat each other and have inquisitions and torture and murder each other. And whoever comes out on top will be the dominant, will be the superior master race. And you'll be the nigga. And y'all from the same biological, genetic, historical, ethnic stock. But somebody got to be the nigga. That's something that's inherent in their culture. If they eliminated all black folks tomorrow, you know, they already putting former model minorities. And I know y'all can't remember this, but Ronald Reagan, during the era of Reagan era, the Carter era, the Ford era, Arab Americans were considered model minorities. And the Arab world, the Middle East was not only the source of our oil, It was the bulkhead. It was the wall against the expansion of the dark empire, communism. And so in this country, Arabs were embraced. And black folks was like, look at these people. They come from Lebanon. They come from Palestine. They come from Saudi Arabia. They come from Iraq. And they build themselves up in this country. What's wrong with you black folks? They've thrown every minority in this country in our face, the Hmong people. And what's wrong with blacks? They even throw other black people in the face. The Nigerians come here, and then Nigerians look at us. Yes, we come here. I'm like, but that's another discussion. All I'm saying is somebody got to be the nigga. They got to have a nigga. I hate using that word, but I have to be accurate. Or as Khalid Muhammad say, I won't be long, but I must be strong. I miss Dr. Khalid Abdul Muhammad. But anyway, back to rights. I think I've spent enough time down that rabbit hole, but my whole point in saying that is I'm gonna take it all the way back to the source before I lose what the hell I was talking about. But there's just so many layers here. I apologize for the rabbit holes. My main point is rights don't mean nothing. They don't mean nothing. Voting Rights Act don't mean squat. And was it Indiana just said anybody who didn't vote, who hasn't voted since 2014, is just automatically kicked off the voter rolls, even if you're legitimate, even though there's no rule saying that you have to exercise the right to vote. You just have the right to vote if you choose to exercise it. And if you didn't vote in the last election cycle, presidential election cycle prior to this one, then no vote for you, knocked off the rolls, and then you have to go through the process of re-registering. The Constitution ain't nothing but a piece of paper. With free society, struggle, but they died in a vain. Winter in America. So every right we've had, it's like, ask yourself, yes, I have rights. And I love seeing the videos of the Moors and other, you know, delusional black people when they encounter agents of the state, armed agents of the state, and they start rattling off their rights and telling the cop who has a gun to your temple what he is and isn't allowed to do. You know. The Constitution ain't bulletproof. And so, you don't have a right to take my... You don't have a right, sir. Why did you stop me, sir? Why did you stop me, sir? And I've never once seen a cop, like, just crumble before your wisdom and knowledge of your rights. Oh, God, he knows his rights. Oh. Now, you... Not saying that it's... And I'm not saying it's totally for nothing. Because you can... What I always tell people, the cop is not a judge. It's not a prosecutor. It's not an attorney. The cop can only detain you, take down whatever evidence or whatever he observed, and then hand it over to the authorities. You don't have to argue with the cop. There's no point in ever arguing on the street with the cop. Unless the cop pulls you over and right behind him is a judge in a black robe and the gavel, bailiff, court reporter, witnesses. A jury, if the cop pulls you over and all those people are there and ready to get to hash it out, no point in arguing with the cop. You just need to determine, I'm going to cooperate or I'm going to run and try to get away. That's it. But as far as trying to plead your case to the cop, don't do it. But nothing entertains me more than black folks telling the cop about his rights. You know, that's like a chicken trying to tell you, listen, I'm a sentient being. I have a central nervous system. I have a right to live. You shouldn't just kill me. You could eat, you know, a turnip. Don't eat me. Just as you're about to put it in the frying pan. You know, and it's just, you know, certain times you just, your words, it's words like Trump. I have the best words. Even if you have the best words, even if you got better words than Trump, it don't matter. And I don't know how long it's going to take us to learn this. What we need to focus on as a people is who bounds us. Who bounds them to respect our rights? They bound themselves. And we know how loose those bounds are. Just like they put a latch on the inside of the door. They went in. It's like, okay, I'm going to bound myself to respect your rights. And they locked the door. But the lock, we thought the lock was on our side. Well, we thought they were locking themselves in. But then we looked around and we were inside the cage. Being a U.S. citizen is we're bound by the Constitution. Like, if we violate the law, we going under the jail. You know, we're in the sub-basement next to the sap. They're going to, they're like, yeah, oh, you want to be a citizen? Okay, we will bring down the hammer of the law. And Lady Justice ain't blind. She sees color. Real distinct. She sees color. She sees hair texture. She sees facial features. So even if you're a light-skinned brother or sister, oh, but you look at your nose. Look at that hair texture. Nope. Lady Justice ain't blind. So I don't understand why, when we looked at the Dred Scott decision, which was a cornerstone all the way up to the civil rights movement, saying that black people, we deserve our civil and human rights. Yes, we do. I enjoy mine when I can get them. It's good work if you can get it. I enjoy having rights. I enjoy being recognized as a sentient being, you know, and having my autonomy and my integrity respected by representative of the states, and having my other citizens know that if they come and to violate my space, violate my person, violate my holdings and property, then I can take legal recourse. Yep, that's true. I've had to sue a MF or two in my life. You know, that's when, if you're a small businessman, the smaller the businessman, the people try to take advantage of you. Win some, you lose some. You know, I enjoy all that. I ain't dissing it. I'm not trying to give it up. But what I'm saying is, who is bound? Because that's the key word. Who is bound to respect our rights? And if, who is binding them? Who is doing the binding? The very people who have the history of violating our rights are the ones who granted us our rights and who have bound themselves. And what I say is, we need to get control of the binds. Because at any moment, they will unbound themselves, violate the hell out of our rights, and then run back and get rebound themselves. It's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So Negroes can march up and down the street. First, they violate our civil human rights. They murder us. They murder our children. They take our property. They deny us our rights under the Constitution. They deny us. They fail to hold the non-state actors, multinational corporations, private industries that violate our Constitution, our citizenship, our human rights, that jump lead and mercury into our bodies, into our water streams, into our air, the companies that refuse to hire us, the banks that refuse to give us loans in violation of our civil and human rights. They won't be bound. But then when we protest, they were like, okay, we won't give you your financial rights. We won't give you your human rights. We won't even give some of you your right to live, but we'll respect your right to assembly and protest. So we get our right to protest their violation of our rights. It just don't make sense to me. I'm not the most well-versed person in law. You know, I know politics. I know policy. But some parts of that stuff just don't make sense to me. You exit and then you see somebody, a black person, a black child, a black elder, an unarmed black man, an innocent black person incarcerated, an innocent black man put on death row and murdered by the state. Troy Davis, hashtag Troy Davis. Search Troy Davis. They put it knowing that man that they know is innocent, but they were like, hey, we went through all the procedures. It doesn't matter if he's innocent or not. Did we follow all the procedures? Then we are not bound, or we are bound. We'll unbound ourselves. It's up to us. And so we have a right to protest their violation of our rights. Doesn't make sense to me. So, I think this is something we need to work on. Because we still talking rights. How you talking rights for 200 years? How you begging for recognition of your humanity for 200 years? I mean, come on. Black people. You know, it's time to come at this a different way. We got the rights. We said we want our rights. We got the rights. Now it's time to focus on who's bound. And by bound, you mean power. The ability to impose consequences. You violate our rights, kiss the stock market average. Goodbye. We're going to tank the stock market. You violate our rights, the national highway system. Violate our rights, then your ability to conduct warfare, your ability to conduct international commerce will be obstructed, if not totally done away with. How do you do that? Legal, extra legal, peaceful, violent. There's options. I'm just saying, it's time to have a new discussion. It's time to impose new consequences. It's like the whole thing with if you violate our rights, then we're going to act in such a way as to gain more overtime pay and more federal resources and support to come. Or we have to wait every 4 years whether or not we're going to have a president that will give lip service to our rights or have a president that will openly antagonize and disrespect our community. And every 4 years, we sit in our rooms and watch the teleprompters and, oh, Lord, please, Lord, give me a Hillary. My life for a Hillary. It's treasonous. You know, Malcolm X once said in one of his more fiery speeches, you know, if you're not conscious, if you're not educated, if you're not being intelligent, you're a traitor to your race. It ain't just you got to go out and actively Uncle Tom. It's not even that you got to go out and actively be a sellout or an agent. But if you just refuse to educate yourself and act as an intelligent black person, you're engaged in race treason. Because we are such an oppressed people under such a well-organized and sustained campaign of genocide. Such high levels of irresponsibility should be tantamount to treason. You're a traitor to your race just for being ignorant. Now, I'm not as hard as Malcolm. I won't even call you a traitor if you're ignorant. I'll just call you ignorant. And hopefully that will be enough to motivate you to stop being ignorant. But just know, in the ancestral realm, Malcolm X is like calling you a traitor for being ignorant, for being unintelligent, for keep doing the same thing over, over, over and expecting a different result. So, you know, and it's just kind of sad, you know, the founder, you know, the original people are fighting their former enslavers for just recognition of rights and the same dang on. I mean, again, my challenge to you is tell me something that we're fighting for now that we weren't fighting for 100 years ago. In the year 1917, that was a year after the Red Hunt. We just 1 year out of the Red Summer of 19. Oh, no, we're 2 years away. Less than 2 years, full years away from the 100th anniversary of the Red Summer of 1919. And coming up on the centennial of the Red Summer of 1919, from then till now, what are we fighting for that we weren't fighting for over 100 years ago? I mean, what real progress did we make? Because even if you can't, well, we got a Michael Jordan, a billionaire, and Jay-Z has gone from rapper to venture capitalist, just fills me up with black pride. We got a black president. But in reality, we've had black high officials, blacks, and we had more black senators in Reconstruction era in the 1800s than we do now. Look it up. State senators. I mean, we had more 30 years ago. We had more black governors and black mayors of major cities than we do now. We've lost ground politically. We had and economically, if you read. One of our best living scholars, I think he's going to have to die. I have to call him and be like, you know, people are not going to respect you till you're dead. Just like with Dr. King, just like with Malcolm X, just like with Dr. Ben. Dr. Ben experienced a resurgence of his popularity and appreciation of his work only after his death. But we got some living scholars right now. And I don't even agree with these people, but I respect their scholarship. I'm not saying there's a lot that I agree with. There's some that I don't agree with. But if you by the time you find somebody that you agree with 100%, Then just make up something to disagree with them about, just to keep it interesting. You know, if everything they say you agree with, then be like, look how they wear their hairs, though. Yeah, I know. He's a wonderful scholar. His analysis. Yeah, the sister breaks it down. But I mean, could she put on some makeup? You know, just to keep stuff and just give your relationships. You got to have texture. You know, you got to have a little rough patch. You know, just make up something. That's how every scholar that I study, every black scholar that I honor and respect, I can tell you, well, what are your issues? What do you admire and what do you have issue with? And if I agree with everything they say, then I will find something just to keep it interesting, just to avoid the cult of personality. But anyway, I'm the living scholar, the living ancestor that I'm talking about is Claude Anderson. You know, and if you accept Claude Anderson's research, he says black people have not progressed economically, not one iota. Even if you throw in the black billionaires, the black businesses, BET, Cash Money Records, you throw in all the black moguls, all that, you throw all that in the pot, we still, in relationship to white people, have not advanced one step. We've remained stagnant, and in many economic cycles, we've lost ground. So what's this game about? And we're in the midst of, it's not getting as much media coverage because Donald Trump has displaced it in the news cycle, but we're in the midst of what they're calling a new civil rights struggle. And it's the same thing. What was that commercial? It's the same thing. It's the same damn thing. Expecting a different outcome. Albert Einstein's most famous quote. Even people who wouldn't be able to identify Einstein. Everybody knows that quote. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. We protesting in the street. We got signs. We petitioning. We rocking the vote. All the same stuff. We got iconic leaders who know how to get up on podiums and give us roaring speeches. We got chants. We got songs. We got an aesthetic, a way of dress. You know, there's that revolutionary Black Lives Matter Afro-punk aesthetic. We got everything we had back then. We even got the more militant counterpart. I mean, we can't even come up with new names. It's so unoriginal. New Black Panther Party. I guess we might as well call the new civil rights movement. The new, but there ain't even no new. There's no new analysis. It's as though we learned nothing from a few decades ago. We're not even asking for anything new. And even if we get it, you know, the oppressor giveth and the oppressor taketh away. We got rights. We got the right to vote in, ironically, in the 1860s. Then we got the Civil Rights Bill in the 1960s. And here we are in the aughties and the 2010s. And we're fighting for the same thing we got over 100 years ago. We're fighting for the exact same thing. Respect of our human rights. You know. To hold law enforcement and other agents of the states, to hold them accountable for open access and open opportunity within the economic system, to have fair opportunity for everything from business loans to housing loans to academic opportunities. Same damn thing in 2017 that we already had. If by the time you're fighting for what you already got, you got to know that what I got wasn't worth crap. Or I need to get more than what I got. You know, and the only difference is, I mean, ironically, in the 1800s, in the Garvey era, in the Du Bois era, Booker T. Washington era, most black folks were Republican. And then after the New Deal reforms, so something has changed. Now we're fighting for, we're doing this backwards treadmill, this hamster wheel struggle, running to stay in the same damn place. We did it. Under the Republican umbrella, the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation. And now we're doing it under the party of welfare and the party of drone bombing and the party of Obama. So, I mean, okay, that's one change I'll give you. Nobody's ever told me that. So I'm like, what are we doing different than what's now? Well, when we started our civil rights struggle decades ago in the late 1800s, in the post-Reconstruction era, when we started, we were mostly Republican. And now we're mostly Democrat. Beyond that, what else have we changed? How else has the flip script been flipped? Don't even flip the script. Just turn one page on the damn script. Give me something. You know, come with something new. And the problem is we don't even have to invent new ideas. We've got a lot of movements, ideas, analysis laying around. We got John Africa and his naturalist bohemian revolution. We got Garvey. We didn't never really, we love Garvey, but we don't respect his program. We don't study his agenda. We don't try to rework it for a modern era. And the few people that want to bring Garvey to light, that want to sustain Garvey's struggle, they haven't even, what, no internet when Garvey. Most black folks were working in agriculture. Sharecroppers during Garvey. You got to rework it. Garvey wouldn't be Garvey today. Garvey would be a different Garvey. With the same mission, liberation and empowerment and unification of African people, it's gonna have to be worked out different back then than now. You know, just like our oppression. They modernize our oppression. They update our oppression. They used to oppress us and be like, down, nigger. Now they were like, hello, fellow citizen. They love you to death or they can hate you to death. I mean, either way, it's death for us and profit for them. So, I mean, I don't know. It's time for a music break. Man, let me give some good news. I don't know. I guess it's all about opinion. Because to me, this is good news. Maybe for you, it's like miserable talk. But I just see, I see a lot of really brilliant, enthusiastic, and worthy African people who are, I think, being basically squandered. Their time, their labor, their talents just being squandered. Repeating the exact same nonsense. And what could be a greater crime that a people commit against themselves than to waste the labor, the energy, the talent, the fire, you know, the exuberance of their youth, and to just cast it down an empty, dark chasm? We've got literally millions of black youth across the world who are like, we need a change. We invested our hopes, our dreams in Obama, and now we're ready to take it to the streets. And what do we tell them to do? Okay, take it to the streets and do the same thing that got King shot in his neck. Do the exact same thing, ask for the exact same things that failed us a decade ago. Failed us 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. Let's ask for the same stuff that failed us, doing the same things that failed us to get the same stuff that failed us. New civil rights movement. Man, y'all gonna have to do that one without me. You know, y'all gonna have to run that hustle without me. But anyway, let's talk about some good news. Zimbabwe Independence Day was yesterday, April 18th. The country, what, 37 years? The Zimbabwe is 37 years old. You know, we got a lot of people that are older than country. The country formerly known as, Rhodesia. And that wicked Hitler, Ian. Well, anyway. So let's play one of my favorite Marley songs and the Zimbabwe liberation struggle. Bob Marley, you know, put up the loot to arm Zimbabwe freedom fighters. Bob Marley did what our entertainers, what our icons, what our black wealthy elites were supposed to do. So anyway, we're going to take a musical break and come back for the second half of the Bro Diallo Show, AM 1680, Q4 Radio.
Every man got the right to decide his own destiny.
liberate Zimbabwe. Africans are liberate Zimbabwe. Natty Dobit in a Zimbabwe. City Took in a Zimbabwe. Africans are liberate Zimbabwe. Every man got a
life. Oh my God.
Stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
You preach a man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. You are dopey and you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold, and half a story has never been told. So now we see the light, we gonna stand up for our rights. Come on,
get up, stand up,
brothers,
stand up for your rights.
Come on,
get up, stand up,
sisters,
don't give up the fight.
I'm begging you to
get up, stand up, stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up,
I said don't give up the fight.
Stand up.
Live and direct, it's Bro Diallo, back at it again with the Pan-African perspective. I want to share some recordings on the from the Zimbabwe liberation struggle.
Zimbabwe. This is the voice of Zimbabwe broadcasting on Radio Mozambique in Maputo.
Pamberi nechimurenga. Pamberi nehondo. Pamberi neruzhinji rweZimbabwe. Pasi neimperialism. Pasi neneocolonialism. Pasi na Ian Smith. Pasi na Ndabaningi Sithole. Pasi na Abel Muzorewa. Aluta continua.
The Patriotic Front is now broadcasting your program through Radio Mozambique. People of Zimbabwe, victory is certain.
Maputo, once called Lorenzo Marx, the capital of Mozambique, which now plays host to the largest, most secretive guerrilla army operating against Zimbabwe Rhodesia. Its leader is said to be a terrorist. He's so hated and feared that his fellow countrymen are forbidden to publish his name, Robert Mugabe.
How are you this?
For so long spurned by the West and branded as the man who massacres the innocent, Mugabe is now a key figure in the London talks. In Maputo, this is his central committee, his inner cabinet, and these are probably the most educated of the Salisbury regime's opponents. Almost every man here has spent a decade shut away without trial in Rhodesian jails. Simon Mazenda, the party's vice president. Edgar Takiri, secretary general. All of them were educated by Christian missionaries. Some once tried to forge a peaceful multiracial community within Rhodesia. But even those like Didymus Mutasa are now all revolutionaries. It's these people who've set the pace in Rhodesia's 14-year war. There are two main guerrilla armies formed into a hitherto tenuous alliance called the Patriotic Front. Based in Zambia, Joshua Nkomo and his party ZAPU. About 2,000 of his troops are now thought to be operating inside Rhodesia. To the east, with its headquarters in Maputo, is Robert Mugabe's ZANU, the Zimbabwean African National Union. Its army, ZANLA, is widely conceded to have over 8,000 troops in Rhodesia at any one time. Of the two leaders, Mugabe is the least known, but he's grown to become a powerful contender for total control of a new independent Zimbabwe. And Mugabe holds a trump card in the London talks. Since ZANU, even more than ZAPU, is still committed in the field to extending the war, ZANU's agreement is essential if the war is to be ended. But despite appeals for a ceasefire, the latest of them yesterday, Mugabe is sticking to his guns.
There's no doubt that our people want peace, but great bulk of the people, the majority of the people who have suffered under the regime for over 90 years, do not want peace at all cost. They would like an honorable peace, a peace which will enable them to assume the sovereignty of the country. And if this is not forthcoming, I'm sure they'll be prepared that we continue the war.
Could there be a settlement which didn't put the Patriotic Front in power in Salisbury?
No, what we are really negotiating is not a settlement that is just favorable to the Patriotic Front. It's a settlement favorable to anybody, any group whatsoever, which would like to participate in elections.
The image of Mugabe presented by the British press has been consistently hostile. A survey conducted for this program found that during 1978, the 16 major Fleet Street papers published 20,903 column inches on Rhodesia. But of all that they said, only 30% was found in the survey to be neutral or unbiased, despite a cautious system of classification which was designed to favour the newspapers. In fact, 50% of all column inches broadly reflected the views of white Rhodesians, and almost all the news came from Salisbury. Only 20% reported the views of the Patriotic Front. It's an imbalance that a former Rhodesian prime minister acknowledges. Garfield Todd.
If there is an atrocity which is blamed on the guerrillas, the government will fly in people and let them see it. If the government shoots 60 innocent villagers or napalm a village, they don't fly in the journalists to let them see that.
Really? Place the sights on your battle.
Television and radio have the same problems.
Vastly outnumbered by black Africans in their own country and jostled by hostile black African nations along most of her borders.
The Salisbury regime has worked hard at gaining a favourable image. It claims a free press, but often stage manages where journalists can go and what they can see. Even then, news reports are sometimes censored. Journalists are normally forbidden to enter tribal trust lands where 80% of blacks live, so they may have to rely on government handouts. Those who displease the regime are sometimes given private warnings, refused work permits, or even expelled. Inside Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, it's forbidden to use the words freedom fighter or guerrilla. But the guerrillas themselves have repeatedly denied reporters access to their armies, even to their leaders, and so the stereotypes are easily reinforced.
Fully armed and indisciplined terrorists, close to equal terms with trained soldiers.
Mugabe's notorious murder list, an intemperate threat to collaborators, was widely condemned, but no mention was made of Smith's death list. The Salisbury regime actually puts a price on guerrilla leaders' heads, dead or alive.
You know, Mr. Mugabe, there are many white Rhodesians, and there are many in Britain and the rest of the Western world too, who regard you as a thoroughly evil man. Mrs. Mugabe, how do you feel about that?
I think it hurts to some extent. It hurts because these people who talk like that have not taken the trouble to get to know the man. And they just speak from what they hear from others. They read from other newspapers what is propaganda against him, and they take it in like that. This is what hurts. But otherwise, I think it's politics. It's part of the game.
My wife gets hurt by these things. Naturally, she feels for her husband. But to tell you the truth, in politics, you have to have an inbuilt system of shock absorbers. And I just don't care what they say, as long as I know I'm right. So they can say anything in their papers, damage me in every way possible, as long as the people I lead are behind me and approve of what we are doing. That's what matters. The rest of the world will one day, you see, be persuaded to believe we were right when we resorted to armed struggle.
Since they first chased the blacks from their land in 1890, power has been almost exclusively wielded by the whites. The first rebellions were in 1893 and 1896, but they were crushed with help from Britain and the leaders were executed. For Mugabe, these were the first martyrs of the revolution. Zimbabweans resigned themselves to serfdom, but bitter memories passed into African folklore.
The revulsion, I think, started through the stories that our parents used to narrate to us, how the white man came to the country, how he grabbed the land. And in a society where you have a class whose main purpose and accepted privilege is to exploit others, you naturally get revulsed if the majority of the people are being oppressed, being exploited. You can't avoid, if you have any moral principles at all, the call to do something about it.
To this day, while all white children complete secondary education, only 3% of blacks do. Robert Mugabe was lucky. There was a Catholic mission right beside his village. But even missionaries weren't exempt from prejudice. Edison Shvobgo.
We were in Form 4 and were invited by the superintendent, who is a minister, Wesleyan Methodist, to come to his house as a class for tea. We had the tea, we sat in the sofas, and just as we were walking out, we actually saw his wife come down with a fumigator and fumigating the seats where we were, in which we had been sitting just a few moments ago. I went out and cried, and I vowed I'd never again go to church.
Back in the 50s and 60s, black political aspirations were modest. They wanted simple political rights, but even their demonstrations were banned. As frustration mounted, moderation turned to militancy, passive resistance turned to civil disobedience, and the seeds were sown for a full-scale civil war.
You cannot fight these grievances by pleading for their rectification. You can only do so by getting to the root cause of the problem. And that's the problem of power.
But at that point, you were firmly committed to achieving power through the ballot box.
Yes, through the ballot box, that's
at
right.
What stage did you very first consider that it might be necessary, in your view, to use a gun?
To use petrol bombs as far back as 1960, and we were the first to use them, but purely as a means of pressure, not really to try and destroy life, but to intimidate the authorities into conceding, as it were, to our wishes.
Did it work?
It didn't work. Then we had demonstrations and strikes. She participated in one of the best organized demonstrations in the country, the women's demonstration. Thousands of them were sent to prison in Salisbury, and thousands sent to prison in Bulawayo and Gwelo and Umtali in 1961.
Then in 1962, black opposition was banned. Overnight, the authorities turned ZAPU from a legitimate political party into an underground resistance. Hundreds were arrested and imprisoned without trial. Resentment began to burn more fiercely. In 1963, the more radical elements, most of them in prison, broke away from ZAPU to form ZANU. Prison became their campaign headquarters. The young Mugabe was to spend 11 years in detention, away from his wife and his only child.
Then I had the little boy, and then he died.
How did he die?
He had malaria with convulsions, and we couldn't, you know, save him.
She sent a telegram to that effect through my sister, and we got the news. That was it. There was nothing you could do. It was a terrible event. But there was nothing you could do. I tried to get permission to go and bury my child, but it wasn't possible to get that permission. The authorities wouldn't allow.
This is the Rhodesia Broadcasting Corporation.
Then in 1965 came UDI. Any chance of a peaceful transition to black government was destroyed, in the words of Ian Smith, for 1,000 years at least.
I believe that we are a courageous people, and history has cast us in a heroic role.
Britain lacked the will to put down this constitutional treason. The UN could only offer sympathy and sanctions, and the scene was set for guerrilla warfare.
It must be a terrible responsibility to have to bear, to know that you were instrumental in starting a war. I mean, however just you feel a conflict to be.
No. He said that I didn't feel any conflict at all. I felt justified. There was the whole history of our having tried non-violent methods. They had failed completely. And neither the settler regime nor Britain heeded our cries. They just wouldn't move. They wouldn't yield an inch. And so we decided, without any qualms about it, that armed struggle would be the right thing.
Have either of you personally ever carried a gun or fired a shot in anger?
That's what Smith says about me, that I haven't fired a shot in anger. But I'm not a trained soldier, Sanch. I'm a revolutionary, nevertheless.
It's a revolution that's brought out that most conservative of emotions, plain, old-fashioned patriotism. Zimbabweans are always said to be a gentle people. But ZANU now claims to have 40 or 50,000 able-bodied personnel, and it's broadly accepted that they've up to 15,000 men and women at arms. ZANU's military commander, Josiah Tongogara, was the most feared and wanted man in Ian Smith's Rhodesia. He trained for a time in China, but had to learn the hard way how to fight a guerrilla war.
We have learned a lot. In fact, I would rather say Smith is our great teacher.
Smith is a great teacher?
Yes, because all the attacks he has made on us has improved our tactics. So each attack he makes, we sit down, analyze it, make scientific analysis, and then we come out with some solution to it, and that is part of increasing our knowledge.
But Tongogara's army has been accused of grotesque atrocities, massacring missionaries, butchering and intimidating blacks. ZANU blames Rhodesia's undercover troops, but neither side will admit to anything more serious than an occasional misdemeanor. These pictures are published by Zimbabwe Rhodesia's Information Ministry.
If you have got an army of, say, about 40,000, 50,000, you are likely to find some people who mad people who may even commit some atrocities. But definitely, this we are trying to stamp it out. And we have been trying that, and we have never had any official report of a group of ZANLA forces going to massacre the people.
We are fighting a war which is a very difficult one, but in spite of the difficulties posed by the enemy, we take care not to make people unnecessarily suffer.
But I quote from your own publication, Zimbabwe News, all land to the tillers, socialism now, you have to hit a racist settler in the groin and skull hard, very, very hard, before you can get him to scream those words. That's what we proposed, that's what we will continue to do till final victory. Let us never forget that only a dead imperialist is a good one. Now, is that the kind of language that's likely to make soldiers behave responsibly?
This is only a dramatic way of saying we are waging a struggle to overthrow the settler system. It does not literally mean that we go all out to destroy the whites. No, we are fighting a just war aimed at the overthrow of the settler government, which is presently oppressing our people.
You see, I wonder whether language like that might not incite young men to commit the most appalling acts within the conflict.
No one is fighting an individual war. All our fighters are fighting collectively under a command that derives its authority from the Central Committee of the Party.
Inside Zimbabwe, the guerrillas say they've widespread support. This ZANU film was taken in what they call a liberated area, where they claim to have effectively set up their own administration, even to the extent of giving white farmers ZANU passes for safe conduct. They're farming themselves, sometimes on a huge scale, and they're teaching the villagers how to put their theories of socialist cooperation into practice.
Do you find a lot of supporters among the villagers?
Oh yes. We, when we open a new area, we don't just go and fight. First of all, we make a study, investigation among the masses. They tell us their national grievances, and those we exploit and use them. You explain to them why you have come to them, why you are fighting this war. They have to understand it, and they have to. Or you have also got to explain the difficulties which will come thereafter from the enemy, because the enemy is going to conduct some atrocities. So you have got to explain this to them, and you let them volunteer themselves and say, yeah, we are ready for that. We are prepared to face any difficulties in order to liberate our own country.
This man knows from personal experience whether Tongogara and Mugabe are broadly telling the truth or not. Johannes Martens was kidnapped from his farm last year and spent 6 months in ZANU captivity. When he and another white were released, both praised the guerrillas, though in Britain only two national newspapers reported what they said. Now out of danger, and presumably to the bewilderment of most of his white compatriots, Mr. Martens still insists that the guerrillas did not live up to their terrorist image.
First of all, I thought, well, this is it now, you know. This is where the end of my road will be, you know. This is where they're going to burn me alive. This is where they're going to really have the joy of, cutting me up or doing, you know, I've read it, I've seen it, I had it, read in the papers how these people will be tortured. I mean, it's not a secret.
But in fact, you were treated well.
If I must be honest, then I cannot say otherwise. Never have they ever laid a hand on me.
Were the villagers, did they appear to be sympathetic towards...
My goodness me, what do you mean? I mean, how would you put it? I mean, here they are, the terrorists. Here they come and get these people together. They are rejoicing, to put it, you know, at least. I mean, these people were shouting and laughing and happy, and they were actually rejoicing.
Well, I can tell you one story that happened not too far away from me, where some guerrillas came into a small group of houses, and the people welcomed them, and the women went and cooked for them. There was a poor old sub-chief there whose job it is to report anything that's wrong. And if he didn't report this, he knew that he could be put into jail for 20 years. And now that we've got martial law in some areas, if he'd lived in one of those areas, he could be hanged. So he quietly took his bicycle and went off and reported it to the authorities, thinking that they would let him go back and perhaps send some soldiers back with him, but by that time the guerrillas would be away. However, they kept him at the center, and they sent out some soldiers dressed as guerrillas who, when they entered the village, of course were received as true guerrillas would be received, but they opened up with their automatic weapons and killed five people, including two teenage girls, and went on their way. Well, the old sub-chief hadn't come back, but he came back the next day, and the people by this time quite knew what had happened, so they just took him and killed him. And this is one of the terrible things, the division of families, the enmities that are made, the whole tragic story, where there should have been an evolution, now we're in a revolution.
Revolution is an intoxicating theory. Its reality is tragic. Zimbabwe, Rhodesia is now a land of refugees. Not just a few thousand well-publicized whites, but well over a quarter of a million blacks have fled the country, and most of them have gone to Mozambique. Neither ZANU nor the impoverished Mozambicans can cope. Despite growing aid from the United Nations and the World Council of Churches, there's precious little medicine and hardly any food. The result is pitiful. Many of these families have fled here simply to escape the fighting. Many more have made the dangerous journey to escape from the guarded corrals, which the Salisbury regime calls protected villages, but which some of the refugees describe as open prisons. But they're not always safe, even here. Just after dawn on the 23rd of November 1977, Rhodesian paratroops began an attack on two camps near Chimoyo and Nyadzonya in Mozambique, described as terrorist bases. According to the UN, at one camp, there were no combatants, only refugees.
Planes came in the morning, and...
I'm going to have to pause that. We're coming up on time for conclusion. I really didn't want to. I posted a link to the Zimbabwe's Liberation is Short and Accurate History. I posted a link on the Bro Diallo Facebook page, and you can also go to the Diallo Kenyatta and look at the side feed, and it will also be there available on the homepage feed at DialloKenyatta.com. We got just about halfway through the documentary, and it is very telling. One thing I definitely want to say about revolution, there's a few things. Revolution... If you didn't pick it up there, revolution is an intellectual and academic pursuit. And I see so much anti-intellectualism and anti-scholarship within the black liberation struggle, and especially in the era of social media. I think images are a lot more powerful. You know, I was just seeing an image of a brother who essentially is... I see a lot of images of black conscious, rebellious, revolutionary black folks who like to show their guns. They like to show pictures of themselves at the gun range. They'll show them pictures of themselves holding assault rifles and other weapons, and they're draped in camouflage, military, you know, berets and RBG and, you know, the conquering lion of the tribe of Judah. Not that there's anything wrong with that. You know, I mean, I'm from the Midwest. I'm from the Bible Belt, which is also the porn belt and the gun belt. And, you know, I'm familiar with all three. You know, I think I was 9 when I shot my first gun. And, you know, the weirdest thing to me was moving to New York City in 1992. And at that time, you know, handguns were banned in the city. And it was the weirdest thing being in a staunchly liberal anti-gun society environment. That was my first time. Because when I was coming up, everybody had guns. Guns were everywhere. And guns were just like other tools. It's like seeing a wrench or a screwdriver sitting on the table. And of course, just as in Chicago, you know, there was the very high rates of gun violence. You know, just like drugs, prohibition never works. Censorship and prohibition never works. You have to educate and cultivate your citizens. You can't just censor because, you know, for what? But that's not really the point. What I'm saying is, I know that aesthetically, the revolution is there. Aesthetically, it's there. You know, at least they look like they're ready. And, you know, are they truly ready? Is really anything going to come of all this gun ranges and automatic, semi-automatic weapons and all this training and tactical woo-woo-woo? Time will tell. But it doesn't matter how efficient, proficient, or even successful you are with the gun if you don't have the statecraft component of your struggle down packed. The history, the real lesson of Zimbabwe, which is one of the most glorious struggles. I mean, they just got their independence. You know, not to take anything away, maybe this isn't really an appropriate comparison, but, you know, when I reflect on the Zimbabwean struggle for liberation, for decolonization, I mean, it inspires in me the same feelings I get when I look at the Haitian Revolution and Haitian uprise. You know, I don't think I can articulate just how much respect I have for Mugabe as the revolutionary leader. But for the same amount of respect I have for him as a revolutionary decolonizing leader, the same respect for him that I have as a guerrilla fighter, I lose that respect for him as an administrator. Just because, you know, we all, the popular saying, stay in your lane. Just because you can do this, don't automatically translate. Skills over here don't translate into skills here. They used to, in the age of radio, a lot of radio personality, they used to do radio theater when the television was produced, invented. You know, they thought, well, this guy's really good at doing radio drama or doing theater, so let's put him on television. It just doesn't translate. Stay in your lane. And but let me get back. The one lesson I think that we have to learn in fighting against Western imperialism, Western oppression, Western genocide, Western capitalism, as that when they lose the war, they go about working to win the peace. You can win the war and lose the peace in a struggle. And the United States lost the war. Not the United States. I'm sorry. Western imperialism. The colonizers. I hate calling them settlers. They didn't settle anything. We should call them the disruptors. Colonial disruptors. Not the colonial settlers. They lost the war. The empire upon which the sun will never set. The British Empire lost the war, but they won the peace. In Vietnam, they lost the war, but they won the peace. In Korea, they lost the war, but they won the peace. You know, so you have to understand this concept of total war. Africans are like, you came, you saw, you conquered, you're in power now. So I have to go along with your program. And now I've got sufficient Now I've got sufficient assets, resources, and support of the people, I can do my uprising. Now I've won. Now, just as it, when you were in power, I respected, I went along with your protocols. Now you have to go along with mine. That's not how it works. They believe in total war. You wage war against the people. You wage war against the land. You wage war against the culture. You wage war against the faith. You wage war against the mores. You wage war against the values. You wage war against the men, the women, the children, the elderly, the unborn embryos. The very psyche, mentality, and identity. You wage war against it. You wage war with weapons. You wage war with tanks. You wage war with peace. You wage war with diplomacy. You wage war as you speak, negotiate peace. Peace for the Western mentality. It's just time to prepare for war. And so Mugabe, the Zimbabwean people, formerly known as the Rhodesian colonial subjects, rose up, retook their land. And then between 1980, it took them between 1980 all the way to the year 2000 to even enact land reform. Between 1980, they didn't even kick the white people off the land. They say, okay, continue to operate your farm. Continue to engage in international and national commerce. Even when we took more power, we were more humane, more civil to the people who stole our land. We're the only people who liberate our land and allow the foreigners to still operate on our land as they did before we took power, when they don't even allow us to operate on our own land. So Mugabe, for almost 30 years, finally said, I'm taking the land from the white settlers. They still want to have this colonial mentality. 1980s, 1990s, up into the 2000s. You're still playing these games. You still won't honor our state. You still won't respect the fact that you are no longer in the seat of power, that Africans have retaken their land. So when they happen, what? U.S. sanctions. Britain, France, Germany, all the European imperial powers crushed the Zimbabwean economy. But they didn't invade. They didn't shoot any shots. They used their media to demonize Mugabe. In a lot of ways, Mugabe took the bait. They took the bait. You know, but Mugabe should have took lessons from Castro, from the late, great Hugo Chavez. We have to understand we are engaged with an enemy that even if you win the war, they will not respect your victory. They will not respect your sovereignty. They will simply try to conquer you through peaceful means. If they can't kill you to death, they'll love you to death. But we'll deal with that more. Shout out to the Zimbabwean brothers and sisters. Shout out to Robert Mugabe. Shout out to sub-Saharan Africa and the entire African continent and all the freedom fighters and anti-colonialists. People who are trying to move Africa from neo-colonialism, from flag independence to true sovereignty and independence. And true scientific socialism. This is Bro Diallo Show, AM 1680. I'll see y'all Friday for the extended show. Peace.